This evening we're looking at the prophecy of the 70 weeks in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. We saw last week that the starting point for the 70 weeks, the 490 days, meaning 490 years, the starting point in verse 25 is from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build the city of Jerusalem. And we saw that there were four decrees that could be involved in that type of thing. We need to decide which one of these decrees is the one that's being referred to here. So we were in the process when we had to stop of looking at those four decrees. The first one was in the years of King Cyrus, 536 BC. We read Ezra chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. And we saw that that decree can be eliminated from our thinking because it has to do with the building of the second temple, the temple of Zerubbabel, as it was sometimes called, and therefore was not a decree to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem. So we eliminated that one, and we didn't get a chance to go on to the next one, but we will now. This was in the time of Darius Hystaspes in 519 B.C., Ezra chapter 6, verses 1 through 12. And I'll not read all of that, but I'll read enough to get the flavor of it. Ezra chapter 6. Then Darius the king made a decree, and search was made in the house of the rolls. This would be the archives, where the treasures were laid up in Babylon. And there was found at Ekmetha, in the palace that is in the province of the Medes, a roll, and therein was the record thus written. In the first year of Cyrus the king, and he goes back into the same decree that we just talked about as number one. This is just a reiteration of that same decree. And if you read down through there, you see I'm not trying to hide anything from you, but it's just a restatement of the first decree. In other words, it's an encouragement to get the job of the building of the temple done. Cyrus said, go build it. 42,360 went back to build it. They started out with great enthusiasm. Like a lot of projects, it sank into frustration after an initial time of enthusiasm. And somebody needed to encourage them. We saw, I think I mentioned last week, that both Haggai and more extensively Zechariah were prophets who encouraged the rebuilding of the temple. This is just a restatement of that first decree. Again, it's not a decree to restore and to build Jerusalem, so we can eliminate it from our consideration. The third one is in the time of Artaxerxes Longimanus in his seventh year, and this one is found in Ezra chapter 7, the very next chapter from what we were just reading. But remember, there is a 58-year interval between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. So this is not just the next week or the next month. This is some time afterward, and really quite a long time afterward, in the days of Artaxerxes Longimanus. He was called Longimanus because Longimanus means long hand. Apparently his right hand was really abnormally long. They say when this man stood up straight, he could touch his kneecap with his right hand. Now that would be considered a deformity in most people, and I guess it was in him as well. At least that's what Plutarch said. You can't always trust Plutarch, but we don't have much information about this. However that may be, this is in Ezra chapter 7, verses 11 through 26, his decree, and I'll not read it all, but let's just take a look at a little bit of it. Again, remember that 58-year interval between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7 is where the book of Esther fits in to the chronology of the Old Testament. And this is going to be, well, I'll just start reading it a little bit, beginning in verse 12. Ezra 7:12. Artaxerxes, king of kings, unto Ezra the priest, a scribe of the law of the God of heaven, perfect peace and at such a time. I make a decree that they of the people of Israel and his priests and Levites in my realm, which are minded of their own free will to go up to Jerusalem, go with thee. And then he gives a long litany of the things that they're supposed to take through, vessels of gold, vessels of silver, and these are the accoutrements of the temple once again. And rather than read all of this, I'll just say that this decree is not about restoring and rebuilding Jerusalem. It's not the one that we're looking for. This is about provisions for the temple and the restoring of the law. I'll go ahead and read verse 25. Thou, Ezra, after the wisdom of thy God that is in thine hand, set magistrates and judgments that they may judge all the people that are beyond the river, that is, beyond the Euphrates River, all such as know the laws of thy God, and teach ye them that they know them not. So this is to restore the law. And that's what Ezra went back and did. Set up the temple service and restored the law. You're well familiar with how Ezra went about doing that. It was fairly extensive what he did. But it's not a decree, again, about restoring and rebuilding Jerusalem. This is not the one we're looking for, even though this often gets used as the one we're looking for in considering the ninth chapter of Daniel because of its purported dates. I could show you literally dozens of commentaries on the book of Daniel that say this is the decree from which to date the 490 years. Some of these were written by people that I have a lot of respect for. But I don't think it's the one, and I think if we're fair with the chronology and with the text here, it can't be the one. So that means, at least from the point of view that I'm looking at it, there's only one decree left to look at, and if we don't find what we're looking for there, we won't find it anywhere. This one is in the 20th year of Artaxerxes Longimanus, or I've never known how to pronounce it. Longimanus, I think, is maybe the most preferred way to pronounce it. At any rate, it's in his 20th year, and for this we go to the book of Nehemiah, chapter 2. I think probably a very familiar story to those of you who are here tonight, but I'll go ahead and read a little bit of it anyway. It came to pass in the month Nisan, which corresponds roughly to our April, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. He was the king's cupbearer. Now, I had not been before time sad in his presence. Wherefore the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? Artaxerxes would have reason to be concerned if Nehemiah got sick, because he was apparently the wine taster who checked for poison with his own body before giving the wine to the king. You're not sick, are you? I don't think you're sick, but you're sad. What's up with that? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart that I'm seeing in you, he says. And then I was sore afraid. He's sore afraid because he's needing to make a request of a king who has the power of life and death over him. I said unto the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? Then the king said unto me, for what dost thou make request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Right during this conversation, Nehemiah pauses to pray. And then I said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou would send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. Now we're getting somewhere. This is a city to rebuild. It's a plea to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. But is the king going to grant it? The king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, for how long shall thy journey be, and when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. And this time that Nehemiah set is a time that needed to be adhered to. It wasn't like a lot of projects today where they set a time and then they miss it by years and by millions or billions of dollars. I set him a time, and the king could depend on that time for Nehemiah to be back. Moreover, I said unto the king, if it please the king, let letters be given to me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come unto Judah. And a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest. This would be the Persian word pardes, which translates to paradise, but it's a forested area. That he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace which appertaineth to the house, and for the wall of the city. So he's to rebuild the city and to rebuild the wall. That's exactly what we have in Daniel 9:25. So that fits right together. For the house that I shall enter into, and the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. So we have found, in my view, we have found the decree that we have been looking for the first time. We have a decree to rebuild the city, and the wall corresponds directly to Daniel 9:25. So now the question shifts. Since we have found our decree, the question becomes, when? did Artaxerxes Longimanus begin to reign? Because if we're going to know when his 20th year was, we need to know what his first year was. And unfortunately, this is not a simple discussion. I sure wish it was. But let me just say something parenthetical here about chronologies. We do not have enough information to make an absolute chronology of the Old Testament. I wish we did. I would love to have it. I have to be satisfied that we just don't have it, and we're not going to have it during our lifetime here on this earth. You can develop a standard chronology, but a Bible chronology is like a Bible commentary. There's a lot of good about Bible commentaries, and there's a lot of good about Bible chronologies. I've examined a lot of them. The bad thing is they can lock you into places where you really don't want to be and shouldn't be, and they can force you to draw conclusions that are erroneous because you got locked in. Let me say this. We've talked about theories of evolution before, and we've seen that they're all based on assumptions, and Bible chronologies are also all based on assumptions. The best way to figure out what I'm talking about here, if you haven't done it, is just to try to make a chronology yourself of some part of the Bible. If you're trying to make a chronology, at some point, you're going to come to a fork in the road, and then you have three choices. You either go one way, or you go the other way, or you just stop trying to make a chronology. Those are the only three choices you have, because the evidence is not always beyond a reasonable doubt. And sometimes even the preponderance of the evidence is difficult to determine. So when you see somebody's chronology, and it's all printed in color, and it's all official looking, and it's maybe covered with plastic, it behooves us to take it with a healthy degree of skepticism, because the truth is often not quite as clear-cut as it might at first appear. And it's easy for the most honest, well-intentioned researcher to miss the mark. And it's easy then for us to take somebody else's mistake and use it creating other mistakes. There are issues of the calendar. There are issues of sources. It's complicated. There are people who study, they spend their whole lives studying just this. And then they disagree with each other over the conclusions. So I said all that to say this. On many charts, the year for the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus is 464 BC. Probably on the average chronological chart that you see of this part of the Old Testament, that would be the year that is given, 464 BC. And this comes from the canon of Ptolemy. And Ptolemy was, as I think you know, because you probably talked about Ptolemy when you were in school. Ptolemy was a mathematician from Alexandria, Egypt, and gave us a lot of things about astronomy that were believed by the Europeans for centuries and centuries, until the time of Copernicus, really, in 1453. And Copernicus developed a heliocentric view of our solar system, whereas Ptolemy's had been based on the way things look when you're on the Earth. But anyway, Ptolemy was a very bright man, and he made this canon. It's just a list of kings, and he said that the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus was 464 BC. Now, along comes Usher later on. Usher was quite a bit later, like 16 centuries later, almost 16 centuries later than Ptolemy. And Usher, whose name I'll put up there so you can spell it if you want to, but remember, you're going to have these slides if you want them anyway. Usher set aside Ptolemy's date in favor of the year 473 BC, and he did this based on much older historical data, which Usher considered to be more reliable. So here's the situation as I understand it. To my knowledge, all chronologists agree that Xerxes, who was Artaxerxes Longimanus' father, Xerxes came to the Persian throne around 486 BC, and to my knowledge, all chronologists pretty much agree that his son, Artaxerxes Longimanus, died around 424 or 423 BC, sometime in a year that corresponds to that. The only thing in dispute is the year that Artaxerxes ascended the throne. And that's why I've got a question mark there. Unfortunately, that is the very information we need to determine what his 20th year was. You've got to know when he started to know when his 20th year was. So we can do this the easy way or the hard way, and I'm not sure which way you want to do it. The easy way would be for me to just give you a year like I so often have, and you can just accept that or not accept it, but I don't explain how I got there. But I feel like since this has been such a controversial issue through so many years, and people have come down on one side or the other of it, that I at least owe you an explanation as to how I arrived at the year that I'm going to use. And if you don't want it, maybe just go to the Bahamas in your head for 5 minutes and join us back down the road. I don't know. I just feel like I owe you an explanation. I'll tell you what, if I start in on this explanation, it's just too much stuff that you don't care about, just tell me and we'll cut to the chase. But I feel like I should tell you why I'm saying what I'm saying, because it is and has been for a long time an issue of a considerable degree of controversy. Usher's objection to the received chronology, which is from Ptolemy many years before Usher, depended partly on the testimony of Thucydides. And I'm just going to put some of these names up here, not because they're really important to anything, but it's just that people ask, how do you spell that? And maybe a list of some of these names will help, or maybe it won't. Anyway, they're not all equally important, and none of these are too important for the teaching of Daniel 9. It's just I'm trying to show you how I get to the date that I'm going to put where that question mark is. We have 8 manuscripts of Thucydides. He's known as the prince of the Greek historians, just as Tacitus is known as the prince of the Roman historians. Thucydides states that Longimanus had just come to the throne when another man by the name of Themistocles, having fled a false charge in Greece in the city of Athens, arrived at the Persian court. And Thucydides placed the flight of Themistocles — don't be thrown by these big names, I'm sorry, I have to use them because that's the names of these people — Thucydides, who was a good historian, he places the flight of Themistocles between 2 notable events, one of which occurred in 474/473 BC, and the other of which occurred in 470 BC, so right in that little time frame. The first of these was the siege of Naxos, and the second was the famous victory over the Persians by the Athenian general Cimon at the mouth of the river Eurymedon. Plutarch, whose name I'll also put up there, Plutarch in his Lives of Illustrious Men connected the death of Themistocles with the exposition of Cimon, and Plutarch added that, like Thucydides, Charon of Lampsacus — and I know we're getting down in the weeds here, and I apologize for that. Again, call me off this if you want to. Charon of Lampsacus, who was actually a contemporary of Themistocles, said that Xerxes was dead and that it was his son Artaxerxes, who was the king, who received the fleeing Athenian Themistocles. And this was in 474, 473 or so. And Plutarch went on to name 4 other people who maintained that Xerxes was alive at the time that Themistocles went to the Persian court, and that it was he who conducted the interview with Themistocles rather than Artaxerxes. But Plutarch said that the chronological data seemed to him to favor Thucydides, over the opinions of these later writers. We're getting there. Just hang with me, if you can, for a couple minutes. I want to just say a little bit about Diodorus Siculus, because he believed that Xerxes was still the king, but he dated the arrival of Themistocles at the Persian court at 471 BC. Cicero gives the date of the flight of Themistocles as 472 BC. Eusebius says that the date was 473 BC. So we have varying accounts in the sources of these ancient testimonies. And the resolution, I think, unquestionably favors the authority of Thucydides and Charon of Lampsacus, because unlike all the others, they are writing as contemporaries of the fact. They're not way off in the future someplace looking back and trying to figure it out. And that carries weight. Thucydides as I said, he's called the Prince of the Greek Historians, and he's called that for a reason. He was contemporary with Artaxerxes I, who is this man we're talking about, Artaxerxes Longimanus. And he was born about the time of the flight of Themistocles. Charon's testimony must be highly regarded because he was a writer of history living in Lampsacus in Asia near the Hellespont, that is the Dardanelles, as they were called by Winston Churchill at the time of the First World War, at the very time of the arrival of Themistocles. So he's a contemporary too. This is that same Lampsacus that was given to Themistocles by Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes gave it to him and said, if you'll just send me the wine you grow there, because that wine is like no other wine anywhere, just send me the wine you grow there and you can have Lampsacus. So the oldest witness for the opposite position lived more than a century after the event. Euphorus outlived the death of Alexander the Great, which happened, as we've seen before, in 323 BC. Clitarchus accompanied Alexander, and Dinon was his father, so this is much later on. I mentioned Usher, and he's up at the top of the list there under the canon of Ptolemy. Everybody, I think, is somewhat familiar with Usher's chronology because it was extensive and I think pretty well done for his time. He lived in the 17th century. He first raised a doubt about this in 1613. And eventually in his Annals of the World, and you can still get this today, Annals of the World, he places the date of Artaxerxes' first year as 473 B.C. And then this was taken and adopted by Vitringa, who looked into these things extensively, and nearly a century later it was adopted by Kruger, who was working independently but got the same result. It's a little bit like Newton and Leibniz figuring out the calculus at the same time. They worked independently, but they both came to the same conclusions because it's mathematical. And these two, Vitringa and Kruger, got the same answer working independently of each other. And for over a century now, Hinzenberg has been known as the champion of this position, and in his Christology of the Old Testament, he sets it forth very thoroughly. Now, this Ptolemy, the canon of Ptolemy that I've got up at the top there, Ptolemy was born in Egypt about 70 A.D. This is the same scientific mathematician Ptolemy that you've probably heard about in school. He based some of his conclusions on astronomical observations, and that's why people have really taken to him, because some of this he can verify in his list of kings. He can verify with astronomical observations. He's the one that placed the earth at rest in the center of the universe with the planets and other heavenly bodies circling around the earth in fixed orbits. So in the 9th century, his works were translated by the Arabians into their language, Arabic, and from them, the contents were made known to Europe, and Ptolemy's system represents the phenomenon of the heavens as they originally appear to a spectator on earth as we just look out at the sky. This view maintained its hold on Europe for a long time, and as I said, was superseded by Copernicus. But Ptolemy's canon is just a list of kings with no explanations. And it's a list of kings with the number of years that they reigned. That's all it is. It's not accompanied by any explanatory text whatsoever. Ptolemy made no indication that he was making any allowance at all for co-regencies. And I think co-regencies are the key to deciphering this mystery. The canon of Ptolemy ends with Antoninus Pius in the 2nd century of our era. When we talk about the book of Revelation in chapter 6, we have to talk about Antoninus Pius because he's one of the five good kings that went forth conquering and to conquer, as we have in early in the 6th chapter of Revelation. But he starts his canon in 747 B.C., which is the first year of Nabonassar, who died in 734 B.C. So writing about 100 years after Christ, Ptolemy was neither an eyewitness nor was he a contemporary historian of the time of Artaxerxes Longimanus. And much of the challenge against the canon of Ptolemy is based on statements by Sir Isaac Newton, who did a lot of work on these chronologies, trying to demonstrate that mankind is not older than the biblical record says that he is. And he gave a number of solid examples showing that. It's the use of the astronomical observations that has made the canon of Ptolemy so highly regarded. And you're supposed to be able to use the sun and moon and stars for telling time. Genesis 1 clearly says that. Let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. But in many places, the canon of Ptolemy has no astronomical observations. And to me, in those places, the canon of Ptolemy is sort of like Samson without hair. Ptolemy then had to rely on the same materials as the other chronologists. So again, I'll say, Thucydides and Charon of Lampsacus, being contemporaries with Artaxerxes Longimanus and with Themistocles, ought not to be ignored. So cut away all of that. Here's what I think happened. I really said all that for the past few minutes just to be able to say this. After Xerxes, I'm talking about Xerxes right here now, the father of Artaxerxes Longimanus. After Xerxes was so humiliated by his military defeats at the hands of the Greeks in battles like Thermopylae and the Battle of Salamis, his spirit was just completely crushed. And he gave himself over to a life of indolence and ease and just drinking and enjoying his harem. After some time of this debauched living, either his desire to govern or his ability to govern or both was so diminished and impaired that he placed his son Artaxerxes Longimanus on the throne as his co-regent some years before his death in the 21st year of his rule, leaving all the affairs of state in the hands of his son. That's what I think happened. I can't prove it, but it fits with all the facts available. Thucydides never says that Xerxes was dead at the time of the flight of Themistocles. Xerxes, by the way, is the Ahasuerus of the Old Testament book of Esther. Everything you read about Ahasuerus there is talking about Xerxes. And there's not one historic event, biblical or non-biblical, that's known about Xerxes after the end of the book of Esther. It just seems like we hear no more about him at all there. So this allows the possibility that other historians were correct in part in saying that Xerxes was alive at the time of the fleeing Athenian Themistocles arriving at the Persian court, and was the monarch with which the interview was conducted. I think Xerxes was alive, but it was probably Artaxerxes by whom Themistocles was interviewed. This way, we can still give Xerxes a complete reign of 21 or 22 years and maintain the integrity of Ptolemy's canon, but by adding this co-regency aspect to the relationship between Xerxes and Artaxerxes, we're not doing any violation to Ptolemy because he doesn't make any mention of co-regencies at all. And yet we can get Artaxerxes back to an earlier time, 9 or 10 years earlier, where it really seems that he should be. And by the way, historians are moving in this direction because they understand this problem. Edwin Yamauchi in 1990 had quite a bit to say about this. Interestingly, in my personal copy of Thucydides, this statement is made in a footnote. Quote, the date of the accession of Artaxerxes is 465, 464, going by the standard of the canon of Ptolemy. On any chronology of Themistocles, notice this, I'm quoting from my copy in a footnote, there is an awkward hiatus between the siege of Naxos, because that marks the arrival in Asia of Themistocles, and his meeting with Artaxerxes. That's from the landmark Thucydides, page 77. They call it an awkward hiatus. That's this thing that we've been talking about, this awkward hiatus. So what I'm proposing to you tonight solves this problem. If we take, and I'm about to change that question mark there, if we take 474, 473 BC as the year in which Xerxes installed Artaxerxes to be his co-regent, then the Jews would naturally begin the dates associated with Artaxerxes from that year, because that would be the point from which they began to have dealings with him as their sovereign, as their king. And interestingly, corresponding to this, in the 1863 Journal of Sacred Literature and Biblical Record reported an Egyptian hieroglyphic inscription which stated that Artaxerxes Longimanus was associated with his father on the throne in the 12th year of Xerxes' reign. Well, that just fits perfectly with what we're talking about. So, if I'm right in this, and I think I am, or I wouldn't be wasting your time with it, if I'm right, taking 474, 473 BC as the year of the accession of Artaxerxes, We can easily work out the Daniel timetable now that we've got a date. But in order to do that, there's some things we need to remember. I'll give you probably three things here to remember. Number one, remember that the 20th year of Artaxerxes starts immediately after the 19th year ends. It's not that you add 20 years to the process, because the 20th year is not the same as after 20 full years. Just as the 1900s were the 20th century. Most everybody here tonight was born in the 1900s, but you were born in the 20th century. It's for the same reason your 20th year began on your 19th birthday, or at midnight on your 19th birthday. Your 20th year began. That's the way mathematics works. So we just need to keep that in mind, that we're really talking about 19 years here rather than a full 20 years, because it is the 20th year. It's not after 20 years. The second thing is, and this is simple, we've mentioned it before, there is no zero year. The year after 1 BC is 1 AD. There's no zero like there would be on a line of negative to positive integers. No zero there. And that throws a lot of people off by a year. And also remember that Jesus was born no later than 4 BC. I think this is probably common knowledge among us, but we need to just make the point in passing. But we know this because Herod the Great, who tried to kill Jesus after he was born, died in 4 BC. Therefore, Jesus was not born in 0 or 1 BC or 1 AD. He was born no later than 4 BC. He could have been born before that, could not have been born after that. Now, I think with these things under our belt, we're ready to get to the thing we came to talk about tonight, and that is the Daniel timetable itself, Daniel 9, 24 through 27. And using this date of the beginning of Artaxerxes Longimanus' reign, a year carved out of what we call 474/473, a year there whenever they started this particular year or whenever he came to throne, still his first year. And Thucydides gives it as the possible beginning of Artaxerxes Longimanus' reign. The 20th year then begins 19 years later in 455 B.C., for the reasons that we just recounted. So to do the Daniel timetable, first we look at that 49 years that were mentioned, the seven weeks that are mentioned first, totaling 49 years. That at 49 years, that brings us down to 406 B.C., which is the end of the Old Testament, after Nehemiah and others have rebuilt Jerusalem and its wall, which is the decree that we sought for and found in Nehemiah chapter 2. This is after Nehemiah and others have done that work. And then the next part is we add another 434 years, another 62 weeks without a zero year. That brings us to 29 A.D. Jesus was born. Herod dies in 4 B.C. Jesus began. We have statements in Luke 3:23 and other places in the New Testament that are very vague, because they didn't seem to care as much about precision in timing. They didn't have a way to keep track of minutes or seconds like we do. So we have these vague kind of statements like Jesus began to be about 30 years of age. And that's as close as Luke seems to want to come to it. So we come to the year 29 A.D. And if this is the year of the appearance of the Messiah when Jesus was immersed, then that places the crucifixion at 32.5 AD. And then the completion of the confirming of the covenant with the Jews at 36 AD. In verse 24, if we're ready to go on, and we can go back to that slide if you need to, but obviously, in verse 24, he's talking about what the Lord accomplished. Let me just read verse 24 of Daniel 9 again. Verse 24. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression, make an end of sins, make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Let's just talk about those for a second. To finish the transgression. He was wounded for our transgressions. Isaiah 53, verse 5. To make an end of sins. Thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Matthew 1:21. Now at the end of the world he hath appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Hebrews 9:26. To make reconciliation for iniquity. God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself. 2 Corinthians 5:19. When we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son. Romans 10:5. He was bruised for our iniquities. Isaiah 53:5. To bring in everlasting righteousness. For he hath made him to be sin for us who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. 2 Corinthians 5:21. The kingdom of God is righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Spirit. Romans 14:17. He is the Lord our righteousness. Jeremiah 23:5-6. To seal up the vision and prophecy. All the visions and all the hundreds of prophecies made about the Messiah would be fulfilled and closed as Jesus fulfilled them. They would no longer be open matters because you don't fulfill a prophecy twice. It's like a glass of water. You just fill it and then it has to be emptied before you would fill it again. But these prophecies were never emptied. They were fulfilled. Their fulfillments would close them up forever. As soon as the fulfillment takes place, then the prophecy has reached the end of its destination. And finally, to anoint the most holy, Christ alone fulfilled this prophecy. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. Luke 4:18. God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and with power. Acts 10:38. The very word Messiah means anointed. Messiah is the Hebrew, Christ is the Greek, and anointed is the English translation of both those words from the Hebrew and the Greek. So the point here is that these prophecies cannot possibly apply to anybody else other than Jesus himself. That's why I asked that rabbi, as I told you last week, what do you do with the 9th chapter of Daniel? And he said, well, I'm sure we have an answer for it, and that was the most I got out of it. We went on and talked about it a while, and then he said, if I thought you were here to convert us, I wouldn't give you the time of day. You know, I was talking to a blank wall. And that says something. He didn't want to talk about the 9th chapter of Daniel. I don't know if he was just saying, I don't know anything about it, I don't care anything about it, or if he was just defensive about it. I couldn't tell. But anyway, now there's another aspect here we need to look at in verse 27, that he would confirm the covenant. In verse 27, he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. This is the covenant made with Abraham clear back in the 12th chapter of Genesis. In the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and he would do this by his crucifixion. By his death, the Messiah brought about the cessation of the Old Testament sacrificial system. All those rams, lambs, and sheep that were slaughtered were done away with. You didn't need that anymore. Because of the death of this one Lamb of God. And when that happened, when that death happened, then the temple veil was rent in two from top to bottom. This was a tremendous piece of work, this temple veil. I have read, and I don't know whether to believe this or not, but I've read, and you know how it is to put up something that's heavy. You're trying to latch it over something, but it's hanging down, and it's pulling down on you, so maybe you get somebody else to come and push part of that up so you can reach higher. They say that it took 200 men working together to put this veil up. Again, I don't know if that's right or not. Could be a Jewish fable. But if true, or if anywhere close to true, that's a heavy veil. And for this to be torn in two from top to bottom by the power of God, done again by the divine agency without hand, that is making quite a statement. And the statement is that the Mosaic system is over and the most holy place in the temple is now meaningless. So I've just exposed it all because it's meaningless now. We're under a completely different system, a different dispensation now. But the covenant with the Jews had to be confirmed for 1 week. 1 week, of course, is 7 years. The crucifixion occurred in the midst of that week, but there's still the rest of that week. Jesus had told his apostles, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. Go ye into all the world and teach all nations, baptizing them. And the apostles did that, but they didn't do it right away. This confuses some people sometimes. Why didn't they do it right away? Because they confirmed the covenant with the Jews for the rest of this 70th prophetic week. The gospel had to go to the Jew first. and then also to the Greek. There were thousands of Jews converted before the first Gentiles were converted. Jesus had predicted, you shall be witnesses unto me both in Jerusalem and Samaria, Jerusalem and Judea, all Judea, and then Samaria, and to the uttermost parts of the earth. But it's not until the 8th chapter of Acts. We got the church starting in chapter 2. It's not until the 8th chapter of Acts that Philip goes up to Samaria. Why did he do that? Didn't he know that the Lord had told his apostles in Matthew 10, go ye not in the way of the Samaritans, and into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not. Go ye not in the way of the Gentiles, but go ye rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Didn't Peter and John remember that when they departed as a team and went up to support the work that Philip had started in Samaria? Of course they remembered it, but the Lord had told them to preach the gospel everywhere, and now they were released by the Holy Spirit to begin that work. It's not until the 9th chapter of Acts that Paul, the great apostle to the Gentiles, is converted. It's not until the 10th chapter of Acts that Peter is sent to the household of Cornelius. It's not until the 13th chapter of Acts that Paul at Antioch, frustrated at having the gospel rejected by the Jews, declares it was necessary that the word of God should first have been spoken to you, that is, you Jews, and that seeing now that you put it from you and you judge yourselves unworthy of everlasting life, he said, lo, we turn to the Gentiles, for so hath the Lord commanded us. That's Acts 13, verses 46 and 47. Why was it necessary that the new covenant message be spoken first to the Jews? Because with the Jews, he confirmed his covenant with many for 1 week. And I wish we had a more precise timeline for the book of Acts, but we face the same situation we faced with the Old Testament. We just don't have enough information to make one. We don't even know what year, for instance, the Apostle Paul was born. Pretty hard to make a timeline of his life when you don't even know when he was born. But we have what we need. God has given us everything we need, and I just need to learn to be satisfied with that. We can't fully satisfy our curiosity. I mean, I would love to have a 1,000-page biography of the Apostle Paul that I knew was true in every detail and gave me all the years. I would love that. But we're just not going to have it in this world. Apparently, we don't need it. We're not even given in the Bible information about his death, because even though he's enslaved in a house arrest in Rome, when the book of Acts ends, the gospel is free. The gospel is being proclaimed. The saints of Caesar's household salute you, says Paul. So we don't need to know. I don't need to know when he was born, when he died. That's just not the purpose of the book of Acts. Now, there's also a prediction in the latter part of verse 27 that was to be fulfilled a little later on. Jesus had predicted the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. And he said that all these things shall come upon this generation that he was speaking to at the time. And he doesn't give a timeline for this. This is outside the time of the 70 weeks, but it is predicted in this prophecy in verse 26. After 62 weeks shall the Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, that is, with a flood of soldiers, and unto the end of the war desolations are dependent. This is the end of the great Jewish war, or near the end of the great Jewish war. It lasted from 66 to 73 A.D., and the destruction of Jerusalem coming in the year 70 A.D. The prince that shall come is Titus. Vespasian comes first. He gets called back to Rome to be made into the emperor, and his son Titus is the prince that really destroys the city of Jerusalem. So the Roman armies came in and destroyed Jerusalem and its temple in 70 AD. The whole temple area was made desolate, and it never has been rebuilt, although Julian the Apostate tried to rebuild the temple more than once. In 363 A.D., he wanted to bring all paganism back, and to him, Judaism was a part of paganism because it wasn't Christianity. Christianity had become dominant at that time. Julian is called the apostate because he wanted to bring paganism back, and in his mind, that included Judaism. So he set people to work rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem, and I don't know what happened, but we have this documented that fire came out of the ground and burned some of these workmen to death. I think what happened, there were underground pockets of gas, and somebody hit a spade on a rock and a spark ignited that gas. And that happened more than once. And so I can't explain it, but it seems to be authentic. So after workmen were burnt on more than one occasion in the time of Julian the Apostate trying to rebuild the Jewish temple, it seemed that we kind of had the idea then that God didn't want that rebuilt. We got all kinds of people today saying that the temple is going to be rebuilt in Jerusalem. I seriously doubt it. But even if that does happen, it will have absolutely no religious significance in the eyes of God or in our eyes, because God's temple today is collectively his people, the church. The point of Daniel 9 is this, whether you understood everything we're talking about or not, here's the main point. A God who is this sure and this faithful to his promises is still our God tonight. And he has promised you something, and he's not slack concerning it, and he's going to bring it to pass. You know whom you have believed and are persuaded that he is able to keep that which you have committed unto him against that day. And it's time. Somebody's alarm is going off right now. So wake up. Time for the announcements, whoever's got them tonight.